Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. In last fall's financial crisis, banks that were too big to fail got billions and billions in public bailout dollars when they teetered and nearly fell. Too big to fail became the buzz phrase for all that was wrong with the American banking system and Wall Street. But setting it right is a giant, slippery challenge. Last week, the Financial Stability Improvement Act of 2009 got a rough reception in House hearings. Now the Senate's weighing in. The stakes could not be bigger. This hour, On Point, fixing too big to fail. You can join the conversation. How do we escape the moral hazard and bailout trap of too big to fail? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we'll hear from Congressman Barney Frank, chair of the House Financial Services Committee, who's leading the charge for the Financial Stability Improvement Act, and from California Congressman Brad Sherman, a leading critic of the legislation. Joining me first in the studio is Kenneth Rogoff, professor of economics and public policy at Harvard University. He was chief economist and director of research at the International Monetary Fund from 2001 to 2003. His new book with Carmen Reinhart out this week is This Time It's Different, 8 Centuries of Financial Folly. Ken Rogoff, great to have you. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Tom.
So 8 centuries of this. We know in your book you're taking the really, really long view, and we want to look at that. But we're also focused right now on not repeating what happened 1 year ago. Can you give us a sense of what's on the table now? The House is kind of out front here. Barney Frank sort of carrying the administration's water here. Tim Geithner right in the middle of it as well. How do they want to try and avoid that, sort of taking that bullet again of giant bailouts for banks that are too big to fail?
Well, they're in a tough bind because the way that they chose to get out of the panic, the financial crisis, was to guarantee everything, especially the big banks.
A year ago,
that you can't fail. They didn't let them fail, especially they didn't let the people who lent money lose anything. And now they're saying, but we're not going to let it happen again. We're not going to get painted into that again. And, of course, the lesson everybody learned is that they will do it again. My 11-year-old daughter, Juliana, has me wrapped around her finger. And if she does something wrong and I say, Juliana, I'm going to let you off, but next time I'm going to be really tough. She knows what lesson to learn, and I think the banks do too.
But the point is they're trying to change the dynamic or change the relationships here. What they're saying, what Barney Frank, Tim Geithner are saying is last fall we didn't have the tools to get in there and resolve these things. Even if that meant kind of taking the bank apart, we couldn't do it. We had no choice. It was throw, oceans of cash at this or see a meltdown. What's the middle way they're aiming for?
Well, they're certainly, trying to do the right thing, but it's really complicated. Finance is really complicated. The basic point is that they want to have a way to put these banks into bankruptcy early if they get into trouble so that they don't have them all going under at once and then they're not able to let anyone go under.
Or so we don't repeat the Lehman Brothers fiasco of last fall.
So we don't repeat the Lehman Brothers, but to try to do it so that they're plucking them off early. And they have lots of interesting ideas trying to have them have more capital, more money of their own to lose to make them more cautious. They have less at stake. There are these ideas floating around about having a living will so that the bank puts in place how it's going to get taken apart. I'm not a lawyer. Don't ask me how this is going to work. There are ideas like this floating around to make it easier.
But somebody would have the authority under this plan to get in there and actually dismember the bank, sell off pieces of it, sort of take it to pieces, even go to bankruptcy if necessary.
Tom, that's the question. So there's a lot of contention in Congress about who would have the authority. Would it be the Federal Reserve, some overseer? And a big question is it can be stopped. Will it be hardwired that the bank goes under if it runs into trouble? Because if it's not, it's going to be very tempting to pull back. On the other hand, if they hardwire it, what if we mess up? What if we have the banks going under and something happened we didn't think of? It's a complicated problem.
Now, the thing that has all citizens' attention is the bailout, because that was hundreds of billions of dollars, bailouts for huge banks who drove us to this cliff and partway off it last year. The answer in this legislation in the House at least, is they're saying the public will not bail these banks out again, or shouldn't. It would be other banks. Once one bank is in trouble, other banks would then be, last week they were saying, would be sort of a dunned, sort of a tapped to pitch in billions themselves to bail out the brother bank or sister that had gone down.
You know, it sounds good on paper, and I certainly applaud having the banks pay some tax, especially on their short-term borrowing, which over the centuries is really the root of all evil in these crises. But once the crisis happens, the system's under stress. You can't say, well, this bank's going under, why don't you pay for it? Because the other banks are in trouble at the same time. So you need to collect the money in advance. And then, of course, the banks say, oh, that's too much. We're not going to go under. We're not going to run into trouble. It becomes political. That's the real question. They're going to pay how much?
Last week, the head of the FDIC, Sheila Bair, was very critical in hearings before Barney Frank's committee. And she said, you know, as you are saying, afterward is too late. Then you can't tap the other banks because they'll be under stress, too. These things are always systemic. Have the money in advance. Tim Geithner apparently didn't want to get it in advance because then there's a pot of money sitting there kind of waiting to rescue you. It's like a visible safety net if it's already there. Many people are saying this is to try avoid bailouts. But just in the effort to avoid it, you set up a kind of obvious safety blast zone here. You almost tempt people into counting on a bailout. You almost tempt them in your very effort to avoid it.
I'm with Sheila Bair here. I mean, everyone thinks they're going to get bailed out anyway, so we might as well make them pay something in advance, especially on short-term borrowing. That is really the thing that we see at the root of every crisis over history. Too much short-term borrowing, things look good, but confidence is fickle, and when confidence evaporates, you implode. And that's what we need to avoid. I fear that the legislation is too complicated and indirect and not focusing squarely on the root of the problem.
You've said it may fix it for a few years, but it won't fix it for enough years.
Well, I mean, the question is, how much are they going to do? So I think if we get it right, which is not easy, we'll still have a financial crisis, but maybe not in our lifetime, maybe 50 to 75 years. But if we don't, it could be 10 or 15. I wouldn't necessarily say a few years. They've really got to juice things up to make that happen. But 10 or 15 years is all too soon to have another crisis like this.
And, of course, all we're seeing so far is what's going to be proposed. Once it hits the floor of the House and the Senate, there's room for all kinds of amendments. We could see watering down here. The banking industry certainly has an interest in getting in there and protecting its privileged status, the big banks.
Oh, goodness. One of the ironies in all of this is that who gave us the financial crisis? It was really these same legislators, these same institutions and regulators that oversaw the run-up to the crisis. And now they're being asked to fix it. They have a lot of the same political economy problems we started with.
Kenneth Rogoff, this time it's different, your new book, 8 Centuries of Financial Folly. You're looking at the really long curve of banking here. Put where we are in that long curve, why have banks become so big? Why have they become too big to fail? Has that always been a problem? Is there something about our globalized era that makes it appear necessary to have banks that are at the same time too big to fail?
It's always been a problem having banks be really large and influential in countries across the centuries. And what's sort of remarkable is many characteristics of our banking crisis, what happened to housing, what happened in the run-up to debt. It's just normal. We might have seen it coming.
But what about more drastic solutions? I mean, Barney Frank's talking about and Tim Geithner having the tools to address this if it happens again. But George Shultz, the former Treasury Secretary, says, hey, just bust them up. Break them up. Don't let them be that big.
Yeah, well, I mean, just having the tools, you have to be willing to use them. That comes back to this question of, do you hardwire their default so that you can't stop it? Because if you can, you probably will. So that's really the argument.
Because the political pressure will be so good not to let them go down.
And you're scared. You don't know what's going to happen. I mean, it wasn't all just about not having the tools. A lot of it was what is going
to
happen.
Who wants to touch this burning building?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. We don't know what's going to happen. So I think the case against just breaking them up is that we really have the crises when a lot of our banks get into trouble. And if 10 small banks get into trouble, 10 medium-sized banks, we might be faced with the same conundrum as one big bank. But I have to say, I think it's worth a try doing that as well, to have at least a big tax on being a large bank.
What about, or that's George Shultz's idea. Paul Volcker, the former head of the Federal Reserve, says, more or less, bring back Glass-Steagall. Don't let these big gambling, trading, investment operations also be deposit-taking commercial banks. Why not draw that line again?
Well, I mean, I think the element I agree with Paul Volcker is we don't want to give the banks the political protection that they have grandma's money and we have to save them to protect grandma. So to put plain vanilla retail deposit taking somewhere else to at least change the political economy. We don't change the economics. If they pile up on short-term borrowing,
but
and
the
then
pressure changes.
The pressure. That's exactly.
That's not on the table, though, as far as I can see. Redrawing Glass-Steagall.
No, Paul Volcker has pushed for that. Mervyn King in the United Kingdom has suggested that, but I don't think that's really on the table. It's only a piece. If you still let them borrow short-term, we're still going to be scared of what happens when these big investment banks and financial institutions go bust.
It almost sounds like we can't get out of this trap, but surely we can. I mean, we can't afford to go back to what happened a year ago of too big to fail.
The big issue is cutting back on short-term borrowing, putting in serious capital restrictions, serious restraints on how much banks and other entities can borrow short-term. And I might add the government ought to pay attention to this too, because government debt in the U.S. is piling up. If we borrow a lot short-term, which we're doing more and more, we will run into trouble the same way the banks have.
The Argentina scenario.
The Argentina scenario of a sort.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about how to fix too big to fail on Wall Street. And the battle in Congress right now over reining in the big banks. Kenneth Rogoff is with us. His latest book is This Time Is Different, 8 Centuries of Financial Folly, former chief economist for the International Monetary Fund, professor of economics and public policy at Harvard University. In just a moment, we'll hear from California Congressman Brad Sherman. We'll hear from Barney Frank, chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, in this hour. Barney Frank held hearings last week. He got some pretty tough going over, he and Tim Geithner, for what the administration is pushing in the Financial Stability Improvement Act of 2009. Here's FDIC Chief Sheila Bair laying down several criticisms of the proposal, testifying last Thursday on how the cost of resolving a mega bank failure should be covered.
Ending too big to fail and the moral hazard it brings requires meaningful restraints on all types of government assistance, whatever its source. Any support should be subject at a minimum to the safeguards existing today in the systemic risk procedures. To protect taxpayers, working capital for this new resolution process should be pre-funded through industry assessments. We believe a pre-funded reserve has significant advantages over an ex-post fund.
Pre-fund it, post-fund it. There's criticism on a lot of sides here. Word out today that Barney Frank may be going for the pre-funding, that is having banks chip in advance to guard against or have cash on hand in case one of their number should go down. Or get in big trouble. Joining us right now from Washington, Congressman, Democrat from California, Brad Sherman is here. He's a member of the House Financial Services Committee. He's been a leading critic of the Financial Stability Improvement Act of 2009, has called it TARP on steroids. Congressman Sherman, thanks very much for being here.
Well, I want to stress, I support most of the bill, but I've been concerned with those provisions that would allow taxpayer funds to be advanced by the tens and even hundreds of billions of dollars to bail out Wall Street. It looks like those provisions may be going through some changes, and I know you'll have Chairman Frank on in the next segment. The key is not only we need to pre-fund whatever bailout fund is going to be there, but that any taxpayer money that is given to that fund should be done so only with the approval of future Congresses. That will send the message to Wall Street that they may have this pre-funded amount, but the big bucks from the taxpayer probably won't be available, because I don't think any future Congress is going to easily provide tens and hundreds of billions to bail out.
Congressman Sherman, your criticism last week was that what was on the table might actually have fewer sort of caps and limits on it than TARP did a year ago, though.
I think what's on the table, at least in the House, may change, but what was put on the table by the Secretary of the Treasury had fewer limits. TARP was temporary. The Treasury proposal was permanent. TARP was limited to $700 billion. The Treasury proposal was unlimited. It's my hope that when we finally get a draft of the bill to mark up, I believe, Tuesday, that we'll see that unlimited taxpayer funds in the future will be available only through a vote of Congress in the future. And that would mean that Wall Street really couldn't rely on bailouts from Washington. That will provide market discipline in a way that 1,000 regulators might not be able to provide, although you might want the 1,000 regulators as well.
Do you think in the face of a crisis like we saw last fall, Congressman, that Congress would stand up and say no if, let's say, the Treasury Secretary and all the, you know, kings of Wall Street were saying bail us out or the whole thing's going down? Would Congress say no?
Well, I think it would be extremely close. Keep in mind the House voted one way and then the other. And many of my colleagues who voted for the TARP have told me they'd never do that again. Of course, we don't expect to have a crisis until maybe we're gone and another generation of Congress members is there. But I would say if you're on Wall Street and you say, I'm going to lend money to an entity because it's too big to fail, and if the balance sheet is weak, the political connections are strong, I would think again, because I think the House of Representatives is very bailout skeptical, and that will continue to be the case for decades to come.
Now, this legislation is not just about bailing out, whether the money would come from other banks or from the public. It's also about resolution authority. Describe that for us. That it would allow the executive, the president, the Treasury Department to come in and kind of take these banks apart, almost a bankruptcy kind of proceeding?
Yes, it's you could call it a bankruptcy judge on steroids. It is the resolution process that the depository institutions go through, where you have the FDIC come in with which is really an entity with the specialization in unwinding and liquidating or finding a buyer for a financial institution that's in trouble.
And who would it be? The FDIC in charge there, or Treasury, yeah, or the Federal Reserve? Where's the authority in this resolution authority?
If you had to put it in one place, you'd say it's the FDIC, but throughout the draft, there are requirements that to do this or to do that requires the consent of either Treasury or the Fed or both. My concern on checks and balances, that checks and balances is supposed to involve the executive and the legislative branch being checks on each other. And at least as the bill was originally drafted, the idea of checks and balances was, well, we'll have this executive branch would have to agree with that executive branch in order to do anything.
Congressman, we have listeners with questions. May we take a couple for you?
Sure.
Omaha, Nebraska. Bill, you're on the air with Congressman Brad Sherman of California.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Let's talk briefly about too big to fail. I'll keep it succinct. I think that we're trying to make this issue far more complex than it really is. The bottom line is that no amount of legislation, no new regulation is going to change this. The only thing that's going to change it is if you tie compensation to risk, and right now that doesn't happen on Wall Street. You can make a lot of money without having to take the risk, and if the risk blows up in your face, you know Wall Street is going to be bailed out. That's never going to change until you tie compensation to risk.
Let's put it to Brad Sherman. Congressman Sherman, what do you say to Bill in Omaha?
Well, we are trying to make sure that the compensation mechanisms don't incentivize risk, but whenever you are working with other people's money, if you lose it, you've lost their money, and if you do well, you're going to be very handsomely compensated. So there is that element on Wall Street. One way to provide some real discipline is to turn to the investors and say, we're not going to have governments protected gambling. If you want to give your money to one of these institutions to take risks, there's no bailout. And anyone familiar with Washington would say a bailout is highly unlikely to be funded by a House of Representatives, which, as I said, voted against it the first time and is eventually went along, but I think is very hostile to doing it again. So the discipline has got to be Before you entrust your money with an entity, look at its balance sheet, look at the prudence of its investment policies, and it really doesn't make a lot of sense to give your money to somebody who's just going to put it on Red 22.
I want to get Ken Rogoff in here again, but one more call. Niagara Falls, New York. Mark, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
One of these things, I don't hold any brief for the banks, but one thing that confuses me is one of the problems I thought was leveraging, which is like they were loaning out
so much, given what they had in the vault, yeah.
Yeah, given what they had in the vault. And now we're telling them that they have to hang on to what they have in the vault, but we also want them to keep loaning money to small businesses and keep cash flow going. And it seems like...
kind of a contradiction there, or could be.
Yeah. Yep. I would take my answer off the air. Thank
yeah,
you.
Thank you, Mark. Congressman Sherman, is there a contradiction in saying, you know, we want you to have a bigger capital cushion, but we also want you to lend more than you're lending?
Well, the real pressure on these banks is to go out and sell common stock. That dilutes the present shareholders, may make them unhappy, but it puts more private risk capital as a cushion between bankruptcy and the risks that are inherent in banking. The other thing that I think would be useful is a program of too big to fail means too big to exist. If we said that no entity could have over $100 billion in liabilities to Americans, we would keep our institutions small enough so that if one did go under, it wouldn't take the entire economy with it.
Ken Rogoff, economist, is with us, Congressman. Ken, do you see banks believing that Washington would not come in again next time because it would be too politically difficult, let's say, for the House to bail them out again? Do you think Wall Street will believe that?
Well, it's certainly challenging, and I had a question for Congressman Sherman as well. How do you see the Federal Reserve's role in this? I mean, a lot of the bailout was really done through the back door, through the Federal Reserve, which can act quickly without Congress, and they use their balance sheet very aggressively to fight the crisis. But what would stop it from doing that and then sort of leaving it to Congress later?
Kind of backdoor bailout, Congressman?
Well, Section 13.3 of the Federal Reserve Act gives the Federal Reserve huge powers to lend money to just about anyone, but only if it's very secured. And Bernanke and others have testified that at least for now, they interpret that provision as requiring that they invest only in the most creditworthy instruments, albeit they found a way to invest many hundreds of billions of dollars in some in what they consider to be very creditworthy instruments. What the bill before us would do is say that can be done only not to bail out an individual firm, but to pump money into the economy as a whole. What I would like to do is add an amendment. I will have an amendment to put into statute the interpretation that Bernanke has told us he has followed, and that is to say that provision can be used only to make very secure investments, 99% likely of repayment.
Congressman, talk to us about the influence of the banks right now. I mean, they almost brought the economy down a year ago, and yet I'm sure a lot of listeners right now are thinking, you know, this is all great, but behind the scenes, they've got more influence than anybody. They're probably, you know, pushing the pedals on this thing. They're going to get what they want because they've got so much money that flows into Congress and politics. What's our guard against that?
Well, the real power of Wall Street is not lobbyists. The real power is this feeling in the country that we'd better keep them afloat or they'll take us down with them. And when you have three cable television channels dedicated to a religion that involves getting on a prayer rug and bowing toward Wall Street three times a day, that's the power, and that's what we saw in last year, last fall, when ultimately we did provide funds to bail them out. I think if we said too big to fail is too big to exist, we would be in a much stronger position. And I think ultimately we have to realize that Wall Street is not America, and that there will be ups and downs on the market that may or may not affect everyone in the country.
But Democrats have a majority in Congress right now, and I don't see the banks being broken up, as George Shultz recommends, or Glass-Steagall being brought back, as Paul Volcker recommends. Why not?
Well, the argument against both of those is that our banks have got to compete against large banks in other parts of the world and service multinational businesses. But I think an institution with liabilities of $90 or $100 billion would be big enough, sometimes in a syndicate with others, to service the needs of any business in the world. And I'd like to see such a breakup. It sounds like a radical thing to do, and though we do have Democratic majorities, we do not have a radical or a progressive majority. This is still a moderate country. Power in the House and in the White House has gone from center right to center left. It's hard to persuade a majority of my colleagues that we should actually take action to break up the largest institutions.
So last week you were warning of TARP on steroids. This week, do you feel any more confidence that we're going to have legislation ultimately that will help us duck going back to or escape too big to fail, Congressman?
I feel a lot better today than I felt last week, and yet the Treasury is still dedicated to having the power to have unlimited taxpayer money deployed on Wall Street and then maybe collected, maybe unfairly, maybe fairly, from the surviving financial institutions later. I'm fighting that effort, and I'll be interested to see Chairman Frank's draft, but also interested to see what happens in the Senate and Treasury. I think we do need to make it plain that any future bailouts should require future congressional authority. And as I keep coming back to, that would mean Wall Street would have to say we're pretty much on our own. We can't rely on this. The reason Wall Street is pushing the idea of unlimited bailout authority in the executive branch is they've concluded that the House of Representatives is not a reliable bailout partner. And I put that on its head. That's precisely why we should require Congress to approve any future bailouts. Wall Street should not think that they have a reliable bailout opportunity here in Washington.
Brad Sherman, Congressman from California, Democrat, member of the House Financial Services Committee. Congressman, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
We'll hear in a few minutes from the committee chairman, Barney Frank. Ken Rogoff, do you hear something that would put fear in the Wall Street banker's heart there, that maybe there wouldn't be a bailout, or is it window dressing?
Well, it's certainly the case that if the House of Representatives has to vote for a big bailout, it's a wild card. They don't quite know what would happen. That was a factor in what happened a year ago. A lot of legislation could have been passed to make things easier, but they were scared what the House of Representatives and the Senate would do. It's just a little hard to know how you're going to craft it all over the world, all over history. People say, we're not going to bail you out. You're on your own. And then when it happens, you're scared. You're terrified of what's going to happen to the system. And I would beg to differ with the congressman on a couple of points. Mm-hmm. First, of course, the lobbyists are very powerful from the financial industry. They're leading contributors. They have a lot of face time with the congressmen and senators. They have a lot of influence. And second, there is the issue of the central bank. That's how everybody does it. They use the central bank.
Open the
bank.
Window, the cash pours out.
That's what everybody does. And Congressman Sherman said, well, the stuff they bought was all very, very safe. They bought stuff like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, so-called agency debt that made the home loans. They bought a lot of these complicated mortgage-backed securities. Sure, they're safe because everybody thinks the government guarantees it.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about how to fix too big to fail on Wall Street and the battle in Congress over reining in the big banks. Kenneth Rogoff, former chief economist at the IMF, has been with us, now professor of economics and public policy at Harvard, author of This Time is Different. We heard just before the break from Brad Sherman on the House Financial Services Committee. Joining us right now from Washington, Congressman Barney Frank, Democrat, Massachusetts, Chairman of the House Financial Services Committee. He is spearheading the Financial Stability Improvement Act of 2009 on Capitol Hill for the administration. Congressman Frank, thank you very much for being here.
You're welcome. I'd like to correct you. I'm still in Newton, Massachusetts. I'll be on the 12 o'clock plane to Washington, but I'm still in Newton now.
And down you'll fly. Last week, you and Tim Geithner were saying, let's have the banks chip in the money to bail out if necessary after there's a crisis. Today, we're reading that you've changed your tune on that, Congressman.
Yeah, we've had a debate about this, and here's the issue. The administration had felt that if we put the money up front, people would that might create moral hazard, and people would say, "Oh, the money is there."
Mm-hmm.
Their view was, "Let's put the money up front, and then have the let's have the taxpayers lend the money and be repaid." What I found was that people were skeptical that there would be repayment, and
all the other banks would be in trouble too.
What's that?
All the other banks might be in trouble too, and unwilling to put up the cash.
No, they just thought politically it would fail.
Wouldn't come. Mm-hmm.
And secondly, though, here's the big point. Nobody thinks that money won't be there if necessary. Look, we are creating death panels this year, but not in the health care bill, in the banking bill. We're going to put some of these financial institutions to death if necessary. I wish that we had that power in the past. We would have done it with AIG rather than having to pay the money. So the money will be assessed, and not just from banks, by the way, from all financial institutions. And the money will be there. The administration feels, they all feel, even Paul Volcker and the Bush administration felt, the Obama administration, that as you put these people out of business and as you avoid the too-big-to-fail doctrine, we're going to deal with too-big-to-fail in two ways, by the way. First of all, we keep them getting too over-leveraged. It's not too big that's the problem. It's too over-leveraged, owing so much more than you can pay off to too many people. We're going to slow that down, and then we're going to let them fail, and we need new powers to do it. So we are going to put the money up front from the it's going to be assessed on the financial institutions, so you will not have a taxpayer involvement there, even as a loan.
So step back and describe to us how this is supposed to work, Congressman Frank. I'm sure listeners are listening very closely.
Yeah, that works. First of all, and this is a multiple bullet thing. We don't have a single bullet. This is a machine gun.
Okay, we're listening.
First of all, we began... A caller called just before, and I was surprised the chairman didn't mention this because he'd voted for the bill, about restricting risk-incentivizing compensation. The House passed a bill just before the summer break which mandates every financial regulator, the Federal Reserve, the Securities Exchange Commission, the Control of the Currency, etc., to adopt rules for every financial institution that say they cannot have the kind of compensation system where if the risk pays off, you make money, and if it doesn't, you don't lose anything. No more gambling with other people's money. And the Fed has already begun to promulgate those rules. We also give the shareholders the right to give an advisory opinion on pay, which I think will hold down the overall amount. So we have already instructed the regulators, no more of this heads they win, tails they break even compensation. Secondly, we have begun to restrict derivatives. AIG did a lot of derivative trading, credit default swaps, with other financial institutions, Goldman Sachs, mm-hmm. Deutsche Bank, et cetera. Under the bill we passed, every one of those transactions would go on an exchange. The problem was AIG issued these insurance policies, in effect, without having the money to pay them off. Mm-hmm. Frankly, they were like people issuing life insurance on vampires. They thought they'd never have to pay. Well, the things they were insuring were these mortgage-backed securities, which collapsed. We will, in the future, have a requirement that these kind of financial dealings between financial institutions will have to go on exchange. They'll have to be adequately capitalized. There'll be no chance of this kind of overexposure. We also have severely restricted the kind of subprime mortgage lending that caused the problem in the first place. Beyond that, the bill that we are going to pass will set up a systemic risk council consisting of the federal regulators whose job it will be to watch for trouble. Had that institution been in existence a couple years ago, they would have said to AIG, you are way overextended. You may not issue any more credit default swaps, and you have to greatly increase your capital.
But didn't everybody know there was big trouble brewing there last time already?
Nobody was watching. No entity had the responsibility to check them. They were state insurance companies, well regulated by the state insurance entities, but they had this national financial products operation. The regulator of it was theoretically the bank regulator that's supposed to regulate thrift institutions. There was literally nobody charged with monitoring their activity to that extent. That's one of the gaps in regulation that we are going to fill. And what will happen is this. This council will be empowered to order the Federal Reserve, acting as the agent of the council, to step in and stop institutions from being too dangerous. And by the way, people have talked about, well, shouldn't you reinstitute the Glass-Steagall Act, which said no banking and...
people like Paul Volcker, nearly, yes.
Yes. Well, in the first place, by the way, I have to say, I voted against the repeal of that, so I'm not defending the repeal of that, but it wouldn't have prevented Lehman Brothers or AIG. They were not those kind of hybrids. But in any case, what we are going to say is that this Systemic Risk Council will have the power to step in and impose a Glass-Steagall regime institution by institution. They could say to this particular entity, you are way over your head, sell off your trading, sell off your investment house, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a combination. We are going to put derivatives on exchanges between financial institutions. We're going to ban subprime loans. We're going to make hedge funds register. We're going to make everybody register with the SEC so we have the data. And the Systemic Risk Council will be empowered to shut them down. Now, last point, let me then take questions. The problem last year was there is now no authority for dissolving a non-bank financial institution. We can dissolve banks. Wachovia failed, and that didn't cause great upheaval. Caused some pain, but no great upheaval. But when Lehman Brothers and AIG failed, there's no mechanism now under the law to allow regulators to step in and put them to death in an easy way. So in the Lehman case, they went bankrupt, they paid nobody, it was very disruptive. Then when AIG was starting to go under, the Bush administration was so worried about the impact of Lehman having gone under that they paid everybody. We are going to empower the regulators to pick and choose, to put them out of business, to wipe out the shareholders, to fire the CEOs, but to do it in a way that is not as disruptive as it was with Lehman or as expensive as it was with AIG.
Congressman, we've got a top economist here with questions. We've got listeners with questions. Margarita, Providence, Rhode Island, you're on the air with Barney Frank. Your question.
Hi, thanks. My question is, how can we, listening to the congressman, he's suggesting this risk council now. My question was, how do we ensure that the rating evaluators are not in as, or that they at least don't have a conflict of interest?
Well, you know, very good question.
The rating agencies, Moody's and all that, Margarita.
We are moving to try and change that. The Systemic Risk Council will be federal regulators who will not pay attention to the rating agencies. In fact, we urge everybody to pay less attention to the rating agencies. One of the things that we did in the bill we just are about to pass, or did pass, was to remove statutes that say that, oh, if you're going to invest in this or invest in that, you have to check the rating agencies. We don't want people paying attention to the rating agencies. We are trying to reduce the conflicts of interest. I would like to encourage a new kind of rating agency where the buyers got together and put up rating agencies. But with regard to the Systemic Risk Council, these are the professional regulators. They are not the kind of investors who would have to check. They won't look at the rating agencies. They will do their own investigation. There will be part of what we're doing is every financial institution in America of any size will have to report what's going on to the Systemic Risk Council. There will be very sophisticated computer monitoring of what's going on. They won't rely on the rating agencies. They'll be doing their own independent research.
Richard, Nashville, Tennessee. You're on the air, Richard.
Hello, Tom. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, to oversimplify, I've been in the banking area about 20 years and in the investment side. Don't we need regulation that the common individual can understand? To oversimplify, why not just go back to Glass-Steagall, segregate investment entities from commercial banking activity entities, and limits the public's risk and failure of investment.
Keep a bright line there, Richard.
Let me respond in this way. First of all, I voted against the repeal of Glass-Steagall, so I agree we should not have done that, and I do want the regulator to be able to impose it, but we have to note Glass-Steagall would not have prevented AIG. AIG was not one of these hybrid banking and investment companies. Neither was Lehman Brothers. Neither were Merrill Lynch. So, yes, there is some problem there, but the biggest problems came with AIG. They were simply issuing derivatives without regulation, way over leveraged, and they were not just issuing derivatives, which were a form of insurance. They were insuring subprime mortgages, which never should have been made in the first place. So we are talking about a Glass-Steagall capacity, institution by institution, but even if you had Glass-Steagall, that would not have prevented, as I said, Lehman Brothers or AIG or any of the other, some of the other major failures.
But it would take some of the political pressure out or be something simple and clear that people can understand.
Simple and clear and not accurate isn't a good idea. The fact is that it would not have stopped the AIG problem.
You voted against taking it away, not me, Congressman, but I take your point. One more, then we'll bring in our big-gun economist, Adrian, in Lincoln, Rhode Island.
Hi, Tom. I'm kind of exasperated whenever I listen to talks like this, because of the lack of historical perspective. Only governments have the power to cause disasters like the Great Depression in the 30s and what we are living through now. The seat of the economic meltdown was laid in 1968 when community activist organizations like ACORN invented the phony concept of redlining, which then was laid down in law with Jimmy Carter's Community Reinvestment Act.
So you think an unfettered market then and now would leave us in better shape, Adrian?
Exactly. Why pile moral hazard on top of moral hazard?
Barney Frank?
Well, that's the argument that it was a Community Reinvestment Act, which simply says that depository institutions that take money have to invest some of it back in the area where they took it. No one seriously argues anymore that that was a cause of the problem. All the Bush bank regulators disagree with that. And here's the best point of it. The major disproportionately bad subprime mortgages, irresponsible mortgages, which were so central to this collapse, were made by non-banks, by lending institutions outside the banking system. Only the banks are covered by the Community Reinvestment Act. And the expertise is overwhelming. The Community Reinvestment Act didn't cause this problem. And by the way, if it started in 1968, when we started going after redlining, why did the crisis not come until recently? What the gentleman is ignoring is the role of unregulated derivatives. It's true there were loans made that shouldn't have been made, but not by the Community Reinvestment Act. They were being made because they were being made largely outside the banks. Congress, by the way, in 1994, ordered the Federal Reserve to begin to restrict these subprime mortgages, but Alan Greenspan, who shares the philosophy of that caller, said, no, no, government always gets it wrong. I'm staying out of this, and refused to use that authority.
But,
and again, it was outside of the banking system to a great extent, and the Community Reinvestment Act only covers banks.
Marty Frank, let me turn to Kenneth Rogoff, former chief economist at the IMF, big guy at Harvard and economist here. Ken Rogoff, you hear what the congressman has to say, the chairman. You said you're deeply cynical that this legislation will accomplish what it might, that there's still big problems here. What's your critique?
Well, first I want to say, Congressman Frank, while I don't agree with you on every detail, I recognize you as one of giving many of the cleverest and most insightful quips on the crisis. So thank you for that. My question is this. Many of my colleagues who've worked on regulation their whole life, but on sort of simple things like meat or airplanes, transportation, are very skeptical that in the long run, regulators can really contain the problem, precisely for the reason I think Margarita raised that, you know, how can we be sure that they're always representing our interests? I mean, what I worry is that if we don't put a lid on this massive short-term borrowing, where there's very little evidence to show that it really benefits growth in the economy, eventually we'll still run into trouble.
Well, I understand, but first of all, we can't be sure, and there'll be ebbs and flows. You will have, frankly, you had very conservative Republicans who didn't believe in regulation. It's true. As I said, Congress told Alan Greenspan to do it, and he won't do it. If you have a government in power that doesn't believe in any regulation, then nothing will save us. We are trying to put some firm caps on this and to limit it. But when you say a lid on short-term borrowing, I'm not sure what you mean. We do, by the way, we have one thing which I think is very important. 30 years ago, most of the loans that were made by people who expected to be repaid by the borrower, and they were much more careful. Then came securitization, the process of making loans and then selling them so you weren't the one to be repaid. I think that caused a great laxity in discipline. And one of the things we are going to be doing in our legislation is to impose a requirement that there be, in general, a 10% risk retention, which is a way of trying to deal with the short-term borrowing. But beyond that, I'd be interested, Mr. Rogoff, what do you mean by put a cap on short-term borrowing?
Ken Rogoff?
Well, it's really hard to see why the financial firms need to be able to borrow at really short maturities, 1, 3 months, even a year, where they're really vulnerable to crises of confidence.
We'd make it illegal to borrow for 3 months?
No, put much more capital restrictions on that kind of borrowing than longer-term borrowing.
But you're not suggesting we do it statutorily, I assume.
Not statutorily, but calibrate the capital requirements
exactly
so that there's much, much less of
that's
it.
That's in the bill. You can't do it statutorily, as you and I agree. There are different requirements, et cetera. But a major role of the Systemic Risk Council will be significantly to increase capital requirements. Absolutely. I think you do that in part, by the way, with the limits on securitization, because I think that added to the problem. But we very much plan to do that. I would say this, though. Those who expect, and of course people should always be skeptical, but Franklin Roosevelt did put some reforms in, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Investment Company Act, and they worked for a while. I think the problem is this. you get innovation in the financial system. It is by definition unregulated because it's innovative. You can come up with innovations that contain some of the abuses, as Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson did with antitrust and the Federal Trade Commission, as Franklin Roosevelt did with the SEC. The problem is, after a while, innovation will outgrow the regulation, and you need new regulation. But I don't think the history is that regulation has never worked.
How many years to the next bailout, Congressman Frank?
Well, we got our legislation through a very long time until somebody comes up with something new that we haven't anticipated. We are going to be putting derivatives onto exchanges between financial firms. We are going to be limiting securitization so that there's some risk retention, so that fewer bad loans will get made. We're specifically restricting subprime loans, and we are empowering people to step in and do exactly what Mr. Rogoff says, increase capital requirements. You can't do that by a fixed rule of thumb, but you can empower people to do it. I think that will stave off disaster for some period of years, maybe 15 or 20. At some point, look, Roosevelt succeeded with what he did, and then within a period of years, innovation came, and there will be new things. So no one can predict that you'll put this out forever. But I believe if you stop the kind of rampant issuance of credit default swaps and restrict the bad mortgages and significantly increase capital, which we are doing. So if Mr. Rogoff has a suggestion about how we can do that even more, I'd be willing to listen. We do mandate the regulators
We'll put him right in touch with you, Congressman, Chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, Barney Frank. Thank you for being here, Congressman. New FDR here, Ken Rogoff?
Well, I wish them luck. I mean, I think they're trying to do the right thing. It's very difficult. It's very challenging, especially with the economy still climbing out of recession.
We'll be watching Quite an Education today. Ken Rogoff, co-author of This Time is Different, 8 Centuries of Financial Folly. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.